Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
Welcome back to Radio Boston. I'm Deborah Becker. The late Elie Wiesel survived Nazi death camps and went on to write dozens of books and win the Nobel Peace Prize. But our next guest says Wiesel's life mission was teaching. He taught for almost 40 years at Boston University. Rabbi Ariel Berger knew Wiesel for much of that time. He was his student, teaching assistant, and his friend. Rabbi Berger has written a new book titled Witness: Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom. Rabbi Berger, welcome to Radio Boston.
Thank you. It's wonderful to be here.
So many people, I think, know the outline of Elie Wiesel's story. His book, Night, about surviving the Holocaust, is required reading in most classrooms around the country. So folks probably know he was sent to Auschwitz concentration camp in 1944 when he was 15 years old, mm-hmm. Then transferred to Buchenwald, and the camp was liberated in 1945. So that's sort of the outline. But you knew him, Elie Wiesel, the man. Personally. And I wonder, because you write in the book in the very beginning that the first time you met him was when you felt that you were fully seen. What does that mean? What does that tell us about who he was as a person?
Well, I'll start with the very end of Night. If you read Night, if your listeners read Night, the last scene is Elie Wiesel, 15 years old, looking in a mirror, and a corpse is looking back. And so we might be forgiven for thinking that this is a man who will grow up to be a very depressive person. And I knew him as a very joyous person, as a very warm person. And he had a certain presence about him. And so when I met him for the first time, I felt fully seen because he really saw people. He didn't see people as objects or means to an end. He really saw people as, for lack of a better word, as souls. And so I think in his presence, many people reported feeling the same feeling of being fully seen in a unique way.
And how do you think he accomplished that after going through what he went through?
Well, someone asked him that in class once. How did mm-hmm. you keep going after the Holocaust? And how did you not lose your sanity or your hope?
Or how did he not become that depressed person, right?
Right. And he said that learning was a major part of that, that process of healing and reclaiming life. And that the process of activating his curiosity and becoming an insatiable reader and learner, encountering many traditions and literatures, somehow helped him to continue and keep going and not become depressed. Mm. But he also had a sadness about him, and I think that heaviness of his experiences and also of looking at a world that had not fully learned the lesson of the Holocaust gave him a heaviness as well.
Right. And so that's why he chose to continue as a professor, because education was so important to him.
I think for him, education was so much more than the transmission of information. It was about helping people gather the tools to live an examined life. And so he really believed, when he looked at issues like war, conflict, genocide, torture, policy questions about the death penalty or immigration or anything, that education had to be an essential component of whatever response we develop, because education is what allows us to question ourselves, right, to encounter others with very different assumptions.
So then how did he deal with the fact that many high-ranking Nazi officials were also well-educated?
That was one of his big questions, mm-hmm. right? Education was not a shield to the German people, nor was culture. And so for him, it wasn't just any sort of education. It was a particular kind of education. It was a moral education that centered on what he called memory, which is the act of empathically inhabiting someone else's experience and learning sensitivity as a result, in such a way that through a process of reflection, we as students were transformed in ways that we could quantify or point to specific examples. The way we interacted with homeless people on the street would be different after an encounter in Elie Wiesel's classroom. Mm-hmm. The way that we related to suffering on the other side of the globe would be different. We would sleep less well as a result of mm-hmm. being in his class.
What would be some of the books and things that you think were almost required reading if you were a student of his?
Yeah, he had a vast inner library and an actual library. He preferred books that had outlasted empires. So he
that's the ground rule.
That's one of the criteria. He always went back to the Bible. He loved other religious texts. We studied the Bhagavad Gita and the Quran fairly often. He loved Camus and Kafka and Kierkegaard, people who really wrestled with metaphysics and big questions and big ideas. And he also interspersed that with firsthand accounts of wars and instances of oppression. And those could have been from a long time ago or from the 20th century. He really honored the eyewitness testimonies.
Mm. Were there key tenets of his that you... What were the keys? Do you think we talked about them already?
No, but it's funny. I actually...
With the reading list, we have key tenets?
No, but I wrote for myself, just sort of for fun. I wrote... let me see if I have it here. Yeah, I wrote the Ten Commandments of Elie Wiesel.
I haven't
shared this anywhere.
Oh, well, let's hear them.
So the first one is listen to a witness to become a witness, which means that you can hear someone else's experience and allow it to change you and carry their story with you wherever you go. Number two is don't kill the dead again, meaning don't forget them. Remember their names. Enter madness if necessary to awaken sleeping communities. You might be perceived as a mad person if you're shouting about things that are wrong in society that everyone else takes for granted. Number four is don't let the enemy define you. That's something he said when asked about his joy. He said, you know, I'm a joyful person because I don't let the enemy define me. If I did, I would be very sad all the time and maybe angry all the time. Mm. But that would be another victimization. He said, any one life is worth more than all that's been written about life. True prophets don't comfort, they disturb. So if we're looking at leaders, that's a good one. If we're looking at leaders and trying to understand who's a genuine leader to follow, they will not just tell us what we want to hear. Remember to laugh in spite of all the darkness. There is always something you can contribute, even if it's just your protest. Worship God by arguing with God. Sometimes there is no meaning, but then we must make meaning. That's number 10.
Yeah, those are lovely. You know, there's a part in the book where you talk about a lot of the questions and answers in Elie Wiesel's classroom at Boston University over the years. And I wonder, is there a particular question? You mentioned that there are some questions that students asked him a lot, such as how do you not become completely destroyed when something as awful as the Holocaust happens to you? But are there other questions that you feel were common questions that were often something that he was discussing in his classes at Boston University?
Yeah, there were several. One question is why? Why would people turn to violence? Why would people oppress other human beings? Why does that happen? He asked that about human beings. He also asked that question about God.
Do you think that this is common in higher education, this method of teaching and of trying to steer students toward self-scrutiny and these sort of deep questions?
In my experience, it's not. It's very countercultural. I think it should be. I think it could be. But I've encountered classrooms in which the teacher or professor is a little bit allergic to those kinds of personal, subjective, reflective questions. And there's an emphasis on mastery of a particular field and the particular tools and methods of that field, as if we are meant to perform a role as objective beings who aren't implicated in what's happening in the world today. And Elie Wiesel's classroom was all about formation, subjectivity. How do I really grow as a sensitive, compassionate actor for justice in the world in small ways and maybe in bigger ways? Mm. And so it always came back to the mirror, the text as a mirror. And we're looking at ourselves ultimately and asking, am I doing enough, and what can I do better? What can I do more to help?
Right. Now, he died in 2016, and of course, there are many folks who feel like we're dealing with some issues that would be very relevant and probably inspire a lot of thinking and dialogue from him right now, particularly the idea of the other.
Yes.
And otherness, as we have this raging immigration debate. How do you think Elie Wiesel would be responding to the immigration debate that we're having at the present moment?
Well, I don't speak for him. I don't dare to speak for him, right. But I'm certainly inspired by certain things that he said. And about immigration, he reflected on his own experience as a stateless refugee for many years. He told the story about how his family lost their papers in Hungary. They were ordered to report to a certain place and bring their official state identity papers, and they showed up, and the officials in charge took their papers and tore them to pieces in front of the family's face. And from then on, he was a stateless refugee until he was given immigrant status and ultimately full citizenship in the United States. He said, no human being is illegal. I think that's a bedrock principle to address this question. And when we lose compassion for immigrants and refugees who are fleeing violence or terrible conditions, we've lost our moral compass.
And so what do you do now? What do you take from all of that and now make it into your life's work to keep going in the same vein?
Well, I'm trying to really carry his message and his voice and his wisdom everywhere I go and share it with people, because he was a globe-trotting Nobel Prize winner who was getting phone calls from presidents and prime ministers, but he met with every student in his class for at least 10 minutes in the semester one-on-one. We can use his voice right now, perhaps more than ever. We need wisdom. We need good questions and good tools to reflect on where we are, how we got here, where we might go next. And then in smaller ways, I try to be a better father and husband and friend and son to my parents. And I really work on myself, like a lot of us. And I do that inspired by Elie Wiesel's voice and things that he said to me in private conversations.
Right. Teacher, artist, and author of the new book, Witness, Lessons from Elie Wiesel's Classroom, Rabbi Ariel Berger, thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
To see a list of Rabbi Berger's so-called Ten Commandments of Elie Wiesel, go to our website, radioboston.org. Stay with us. Coming up, Chef Lydia Bastianich's culinary tour of rural America and some holiday recipes. I'm Deborah Becker, and this is Radio Boston.